hear arguments next in number 5714, Genis against Georgia. You may proceed whenever you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court, this is an appeal from a three-judge federal court pursuant to 28 United States Code, Section 1253. That court denied the appellant's motion for preliminary and permanent injunction against the application, enforcement, execution of Georgia Code annotated, Section 34.10.10. Section 34 of the Georgia Code is the Georgia Election Code, and I think for convenience sake I will just refer to the individual sections as, for example, Section 10.10. The appellants in this case are the Georgia Socialist Workers Party candidates for governor and for two of the congressional districts in the state of Georgia. Voters who desire to support them, and the class of persons who desire an opportunity to consider persons on the ballot other than Democrats and Republicans. Section 10.10 of the Georgia Election Code provides simply that in order to get on the ballot, unless you come within stated exceptions, you must secure the signatures of 5% of the voters who were registered to vote for the office which you seek at the last time it was previously offered for election. It is a straight 5% of the registered electorate. In the case of the lead appellant, Mrs. Janess, the candidate for governor of the Georgia Socialist Workers Party, 5% of the number of registered voters at the last time the office she sought would come out to be some 88,175 signatures.
There's no requirement, is there, Mr. Inskopf, that the signatures need to come from a specified number of counties or anything such as that?
No, Mr. Justice Stewart, we do not have any distribution problem, except insofar as, for example, in a congressional candidate, the signatures must come from
the district.
In the district.
They have to come from the constituency, but the governor has a statewide constituency.
That's correct. Anywhere in the state.
Anywhere in the constituency.
Yes.
In other words, for the gubernatorial candidate, they could have all come from Fulton County, for example.
They could have all come from Fulton County. That's correct.
But a candidate for a congressional seat wouldn't need anything like 80,000 signatures on a petition, though, would he?
No, Mr. Chief Justice. In the two districts with which we are concerned, which are the congressional districts which divide the city of Atlanta, the 4th and 5th, the numbers were 10,000 and 11,000.
Mr. Inskopf, as I remember, in Williams against Rhodes, the figure was 15% of actual votes cast. Am I correct in that?
That's correct. 15% of the vote cast.
And here it is 5% of the registered voters. Which is the more difficult of the two provisions to meet?
As we have attempted, as we have shown in our brief at page 8 and page 9, in Georgia, the number of voters is generally about 50% of the number of registered voters, or it has been in the last two gubernatorial elections. So the 5% total here actually works out to something in the neighborhood of 10% of the votes cast.
Incidentally, is a write-in permissible in Georgia?
Write-ins are permissible. think...
Your answer to Justice Blackmun would be what? Which is the easier?
Well, the 5% here comes out to slightly less than the 15% in Ohio. It comes out to about 10% by the Ohio standard. So Georgia's requirement is some percentage points easier in terms of numbers than Ohio's. I might add that since that time, Ohio has changed its laws, reduced its percentages, and in a three-judge federal court decision this summer, those reduced percentages were held unconstitutional.
There were other factors in the Ohio case that are not present in the statute.
I think that's certainly correct, Mr. Justice Harlan. The first time the case was here, I'm not so certain that it was correct when it was back in Ohio. They were dealing with a number of the laws which this court had already struck down. And it seems that they were pretty well able to isolate out the number of signatures required and strike that down on its own rather than as part of an entangling web, as the court has said. When I say that the candidates here are candidates of the Georgia Socialist Workers Party, I should point out that the Georgia Socialist Workers Party is a political body, according to the laws of Georgia, which means two things. It means, first, that its candidates failed to receive 20% of the votes the last time the office of governor was contested, and it means that its candidates failed to receive 20% of the nationwide vote for president. But it also means one more thing. It means that the party is registered with the Office of the Secretary of State pursuant to Section 901 of the Election Code, which basically requires the party to go through the same procedures that a corporation would to register. It has to file its bylaws, submit the names of its officers, and any other information the secretary may in fact desire. The Georgia Socialist Workers Party has complied with this requirement.
This is the status that the Republican Party occupied for quite a long period of time in your state, isn't it?
Well, it is and it is not, Your Honor. The Republicans, of course, have been on the ballot by petition at the last gubernatorial election before this one.
And they were there by petition because they occupied the status of your client.
That's correct. That is correct.
And their candidate, in fact, then, as I remember, got a larger vote than the man who was later declared governor.
He received a plurality.
Mr. Bo, somebody, Callahan?
Callaway, Your Honor.
Callaway, yes.
Also pursuant to the Georgia Election Code, the candidates of the Georgia Socialist Workers Party were nominated by the party to be its candidates for office in a convention of the party. And a certification of their nomination was filed with the Secretary of State. So we don't have here exactly the case of completely independent candidates. The nominees of the party here have had to go through at least one hurdle before they get to the problem of gathering signatures. Now, on the other hand, party candidates in Georgia, belonging to a party which collected 20% of the vote for governor or president, need not gather any signatures at all, nor need their party in its primary secure any definite number of votes before they can get on the ballot for the final election. And in fact, in the instant case, the number of signatures which Mrs. Janess would have been required to secure exceeded the number of votes that were actually cast in the Republican primary for the winner of that primary. He got some 62,000 votes Mrs. Jeunesse would have had to get some 88,000 signatures.
What was the total cast in the primary?
Just over 100,000, Your Honor. So it was slightly in excess of the signature requirement that she was required to meet. But there is absolutely no requirement, once a party qualifies as a party, that it, in its primary, before it put its candidates on the ballot at the final election, show any scintilla of voter interest in the party.
Except that the party must have received at least 20% of the vote at the last previous election.
At the last previous election.
And that one can infer certain strength and continuing strength in a political organization that has managed to acquire that much vote, I suppose.
Well, up until very recently, of course, Georgia was strictly a one-party state.
Yes, and as you just said, up until very recently, the Republican Party in Georgia occupied the status that your client now occupies.
That's correct. That's correct. No question. I might add that the 20% requirement came in for the first time in 1964. Prior to that time, to be a party and be on the ballot regularly, going back to 1943, all you needed was to retain 5% of the vote at previous elections. Before 1943, going back to the Georgia Code of 1922, anybody could be a candidate who registered himself as such with the Secretary of State. There was no requirement that his party secure any certain number of votes, nor was there any requirement that he himself get a petition with any number of signatures.
Just 5% is bad, according to your argument, or what percentage do you think would be all right constitutionally?
Well, of course I would want to argue that you don't reach that question in this case because we think the 5% is a restriction on freedom of speech. But it seems to me that in terms of what's required in the other states, the vast majority of those other states require 1% or less. It seems to me that whatever the reason that the state can come up with for this requirement, it seems to me that really its only justification would possibly be to protect the ballot against purely frivolous candidates.
Your First Amendment argument would knock out all requirements of this type.
Yes, it would, Your Honor. I think it would. Unless, of course, the state could show some sort of danger which would accrue from unlimited numbers of candidates getting on the ballot. I don't think that, based on what the court said about the Ohio case, or based upon what the state said below here, that there is any sort of conceivable danger.
Mr. Rinskoff, just before the last question, you were tracing the Georgia legislative history and said that at one time there was no percentage requirement at all. What is the implication of that? Bring me along a little more.
All right. Closely. The implication of that, it seems to me, is exactly the same implication that the recent three-judge court in Ohio in the decision in 318 of Federal Supplement found that when Ohio jumped its requirement from 1% to 7% and later back to 4%, the state had to show some sort of compelling interest for that increase. Ohio was unable to show any compelling interest for that increase. Similarly, in Georgia, we would say that there has never been any showing by the state that the increase from no signature requirement to 5% of the registered voters has been shown. It seems to me that the 5% requirement was adopted completely arbitrarily in 1943. It was continued again in 1964, but there's never been any showing, nothing in the record in this case, that there was any difficulty.
What is the purpose of it in your estimation?
I really could not say. It's not like the situation in Ohio, where Henry Wallace received enough votes as to cast some sort of doubt about the result of the election, because in Georgia, going back to 1872, every time there has been a statewide race, the Democrats have carried. So it strikes me that it was a revision of the election code, and while they were revising it, someone said, well, we should put in some sort of a requirement. There certainly is nothing in the legislative history which would indicate any reason for the change from 0% to 5%.
There's nothing in Georgia law that would prevent it in any way, Mrs. Jeunesse or the two congressional candidates from campaigning to the extent they wanted to campaign for the office that they sought. Is there? Holding meetings, having all the associational privileges they wanted, making all the speeches they wanted, passing out all the literature they wanted
it's
favor of their candidacy and urging their adherents and supporters to write in their names?
It's just as it was in Ohio. There was no state restriction on doing First Amendment kinds of things. The restriction is on getting on the ballot.
Well, specifically, First Amendment kinds of things is rather a broad category.
Well,
in answer to my question,
making speeches, having meetings.
Free to campaign, free to organize, free to do whatever they wanted and make speeches and pass out literature in support of their candidacies.
Certainly. I don't think there's any question that such a restriction would easily fall, and we don't have that here. There is one specific problem with the write-in vote in Georgia which may not be present in other states, and that is that there is a direction in the election code which requires write-in votes to be counted by the people counting the votes exactly as they are written. So that if there were a write-in vote for Linda Jeunesse and another write-in vote for Mrs. Linda Jeunesse, those two votes would be counted separately, and however many write-in votes went down under the one column or under some wrong spelling would be counted separately. There would be no accumulation of the votes.
But they would be counted?
They count write-in votes, yes, Mr. Justice Black. There's...
Sometimes get elected, don't you?
I don't know of any recent example of a write-in balloter being elected to governor in Georgia.
Oh, Georgia, but county offices, important county offices.
Well, it's conceivable. I don't think there's any showing in the record as to whether it has ever happened.
You mean in Georgia?
In Georgia.
But I know it's happened at other places close by Georgia.
Well, certainly it has happened. Another restriction on the signature gathering that takes place in Georgia is the requirement that signatures be gathered by a person who is eligible to vote for the office that is being sought. For example, in the 4th and 5th congressional districts, which divide the city of Atlanta, the Socialist Workers' Party could not gather signatures in the 5th district with a member of its party who was, in fact, registered in the 4th district. And this, I think, is an impairment. On the signature gathering requirement, it makes it, I think, somewhat more difficult than it appears on its face. It means that unless the party is distributed equally among congressional districts, its chances of gathering signatures in one district or the other depends not on the membership of the party, but on where the members of that party live. And
is
possibly
this true of statewide elections, too?
Well, of course, in a statewide election, anyone living anywhere in the state would be eligible to vote. Two of the appellants here, of course, sought congressional districts. They were not running for at-large congressional seats. They were running for specific geographic districts. A major problem, it seems to me, along the First Amendment lines, is the problem of one's FCC privileges whether one can get free or equal time if one is only a write-in candidate or if one is a candidate who is duly qualified. The FCC, or at least the television stations in Georgia, have permitted people who are registered with the Secretary of State as write-in candidates to enjoy equal time. They have not permitted persons who are not registered as write-in candidates and who do not meet the signature requirement to have that equal time. So to that extent, a failure to either register yourself as a write-in candidate or to appear, either to register yourself as a write-in candidate or to secure the signatures is in fact a limitation on your ability to appear before the public. In terms of the candidates here, the record has their affidavits as to poverty. They're proceeding in form of pauperis, in fact, in this court. The record also contains stipulation of the parties as to the expense that was incurred by the Secretary of State in checking the signatures that were gathered by Mr. Callaway and by Mr. Wallace when they successfully met the petition requirements. And those figures are some $77,000 and $81,000 by the Secretary of State just to verify the signatures which were gathered. There was no actual showing in the record as to how much it cost to gather those signatures, but it seems to me to be a highly reasonable speculation that it certainly cost at least that amount to go out and physically gather those signatures.
You haven't brought here the filing fee requirement.
No, Your Honor, and in fact we successfully challenged that in the lower court. The state has not appealed. So, if they were able to get their signatures and show poverty, they could go on the ballot without paying a fee. I think the argument that the state has made here is illustrative of the fact that the state really has no compelling interest in this requirement. The state, for example, has said in its brief that Georgia does not have very restrictive laws, and it points to some examples of other states with more restrictive laws. For example, states where if you have voted in a party primary, you cannot then come along and sign a petition for an independent or a non-political party candidate. It's quite true that in Georgia, anybody, as long as he is a registered voter, can sign a petition. It doesn't matter if he intends to go out and vote in the Democratic or the Republican primary the next day. And it seems to me that this very freeness that Georgia offers indicates that it really doesn't have any real purpose in imposing the signature requirement.
Well, I take it then, Mr. Rinskoff, you would be making the same argument if the percentage was 1% or 0.5%.
Well, I certainly don't have to make that argument in terms of reasonableness because, of course, it is here 5%.
I know, but it isn't a reasonableness. If that's all it is, if you, for example, suggested that perhaps the state would have a compelling interest in requiring 1%, then it does come down to a judgment as to how much that is worth. And maybe the state judgment's worth something.
Well,
wouldn't you argue that it's there couldn't be a compelling interest for even 0.5%?
I would think, Your Honor, subject to the qualification that the state might be able to impose some sort of non-frivolous barrier. And it seems to me that
non-frivolous.
Non-frivolous. I think they might well be able to protect the ballot against completely frivolous candidates.
Well, is that a compelling interest?
I would think it might well be.
And how much is that worth? 0.5%?
How can you weigh these things?
Well, why isn't it worth 5%?
Well, I think to go to as much as 5% or 10% of the actual votes becomes unduly burdensome. It becomes, in actual terms, an impossibility for people who do not have some large support.
By support, do you mean money, resources?
I mean both money, Mr. Chief Justice, and people who are members of their party or who might be able to go out and gather signatures for them, to say nothing of people who might be willing to sign on their behalf.
Well, I suppose, at least I could, take judicial notice of the fact that some of the very significant political expression in this country has been by young people and others not so young who were pure volunteers who would do these things if they had a belief, if they had a conviction about that particular issue or party. Now, in terms of collecting, whether it's 10,000 names or 5,000 names, isn't that entirely possible with purely voluntary efforts if, in fact, there is a significant support for the views of either that party or that candidate?
Well, it may very, very well be that the views will be very unpopular ones, such as socialism in the state of Georgia. I think the fact that the views may not attract a large number of adherents is not really the determining factor. Or, turning to the young people, for example, if in fact they were not registered to vote in Georgia, they would not be eligible to either collect signatures or to sign the petitions themselves.
Well, when you spoke earlier, I think in response to Mr. Justice White, you referred to a compelling state interest and related that to frivolous candidates. Now, did you mean by that a candidate who is frivolous because of his person or his views, or a candidate who is frivolous in the sense that he never could get more than a minimal support?
I think of the frivolous candidate as someone who qualifies for office just because he wants to see his name on the ballot. It may well be that even he has First Amendment rights, which would be infringed by any such signature requirement. But in the instant case, they have gone to the trouble of organizing themselves as a political body according to Georgia law. They have filed papers with the Secretary of State. They have paid him a minimum fee for filing those papers. I think they've gone far beyond any sort of frivolous question.
Mr. Castellani.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. Mrs. Genesse's argument and her attack on the nominating petition laws is based on two different grounds. First ground is that she claims there is a denial of her equal protection rights. The second ground is that she claims these laws violate her right to freedom of association, as has been recognized by this court in Williams versus Rhodes. We shall characterize the equal protection argument as the grass is always greener on the other side argument. In Georgia, as has been noted by this court, there is not this tremendous imbalance between the two paths or methods to get on the general election ballot. In Williams, we had all the additional burdens that were placed upon third-party candidates. Ohio completely eliminated independent candidates. In Georgia, except for the actual vehicle itself, that is, the petition method as opposed to the primary method, there is not this imbalance. As a matter of fact, as a result of the three-judge court decision below, if you go the petition method and you can allege poverty, you do not have to pay any qualifying fees. We therefore think that this lawsuit is bottomed on an incorrect assumption. The assumption that's incorrect is that a primary method is easier than a petition method. We believe that if anyone went through both of these methods, he would seriously question this assumption. Now, Mrs. Jeunesse sees a primary as a method whereby a candidate merely sits at home and waits for the votes to come to his door, and he's automatically nominated and authorized to go on the general election ballot. In fact, that is not the case. A primary candidate has to expend tremendous amounts of energy, his own resources. He has organizational problems, the complexities of a campaign, particularly for the gubernatorial nomination in Georgia, are simply not recognized by Mrs. Jeunesse when she sees this imbalance between the two methods. Further, if a general primary candidate is defeated, he never has a chance to get to the general election ballot. Whereas with a person who's going the petition method, once they obtain the required petition, there's no problem with going on the ballot. They are automatically certified and they go on the general election ballot. Therefore, we believe that while the grass may seem greener to Mrs. Jeunesse, in actual fact, close and a realistic examination of the two methods to get on the general election ballot in Georgia will show that there is no inequality, and her claim on this basis must fail.
Your opposition has brought out the fact the 5% figure, though, is at the high point in comparative figures with other states. Do you have any comment about that?
Yes, sir, Mr. Justice. If you only look at the number of petition signatures that are required, Georgia, although it's not the highest, is probably higher than most. However, as we attempted to show in our brief, there are numerous other disabilities that are placed upon petition gatherers in other states that have these lower total requirements. If I might, some states require that when you sign this petition, you have to agree to support the candidate in the general election. Georgia has nothing like this at all. Some states prohibit you from participating in any primary. As a matter of fact, Mrs. Jeunesse could participate in the party primary of her choice in Georgia. She could run as a petition candidate and yet go and vote in the primary and vote for the person that she would most likely to oppose in the general election. Some states forbid you to sign any other petition besides the first one. In other words, the first person who gets to you, that's it. You're disqualified for any thereafter. In Georgia, you can sign as many petitions as you want. Some states require that you must not be registered in any other political party. At least one state, I believe it's Rhode Island, they prohibit you from participating in any primary for 26 months after you sign a petition. Now, we did not make an exhaustive study of all the state laws.
Why did the state of Georgia at this late date, number two, pick the 5%?
Well, sir, the late date was 1943. Secondly, this method was because 49 of the 50 states depend upon nominating petitions as an alternative in one form or another. Florida is the only state that I know that does not use the nominating petition method as an alternative.
Well, anything happened in Georgia that suddenly made them realize this was a good way of doing it?
Justice Marshall, I'm not a Georgia historian. I don't believe I can answer that question.
Well, it's, can you answer the 5% question?
No, sir. I mean, I think that figure
well,
was...
What is the state's interest in the 5%?
Well, the state's interest in 5%, it seems to me, and I realize that this court has looked at an awful lot of election cases, and you have had the interest thrown at you. We think there are probably three interests that probably overlap. But the first interest is, as has been noted by the court, completely frivolous candidates. For however you want to define what you consider frivolous candidates, we think of them as the personal publicity seekers, a person who's wasting everyone's time, if I can use that term. The second interest is that the national movement today is an attempt to get more people to vote, to make it easier to vote. We have had numerous comments about the fact that Georgia had 12 candidates for governor in the primary, and it was just too confusing, and people just couldn't make up their mind. We think that's an interest, to keep it down to serious candidates. We also believe that by having this requirement, you can, to a certain degree, encourage stability and compromise. If every splinter group knows that they have unlimited access to the general election ballot, they're going to just go their own separate ways, and we think that this is not conducive to a good electoral process.
I recognize your answer to the general question, but I'm still led to the point why five instead of one or one half, two, three, four.
And I say, there are no legislative materials that I have been able to find that would indicate why five.
You said that in the 40s when you adopted this, you looked at the other states. Did you find the other state with five?
Yes, there are other states with five. Yes, sir, Mr. Justice. I don't remember offhand. I think there's three or four plus several.
Well, I have great difficulty in saying you were trying to get in line with the other states. It looked to me like you passed some of them.
Oh, we did. We admit that we passed some.
Why?
But as I attempted to show before,
what's so peculiar in Georgia that you need 5%?
Well, they made the figure 5%, and again, I can't say why they chose 5%. Maybe they thought about 10 and decided to cut it in half. I just don't know. But the thing is, they made it so much easier to gather these petitions. Most of these other states, with the 1% or the 1.5% or 2%, also, and this is what bothers me, is that if in another state you go out and you sign one of these petitions, I doubt very seriously that the person who's gathering these signatures tells you that, now, wait a minute, if you sign this petition, you're not going to be able to vote in a primary, or that you can't be registered with another party, or that you're going to be disqualified. Georgia has opted for the other procedure, 5%, but as long as you're registered, sign as many petitions as you want, and continue to participate in the political party primaries, and this is their method. Now, I couldn't give you an explanation as to why 5% was chosen. I'm sorry. I've talked with several people, and They just don't know.
Mr. Castellani, I hope I'm not repeating anything Mr. Justice Marshall asked you, because I couldn't hear his question, but do you know of any reason why Georgia moved from no requirement at all to the present one that's under challenge?
I had a guess, and unfortunately I did not prepare myself on this point, and I apologize, I probably should have. I think that previously Georgia did not authorize anybody, did not allow independent candidates to run. You had to be a party candidate. And then I think that there are several states where this was the case. And in my research of this question, this problem has come up. There were five or six states where you had to be on a party.
So your suspicion is that Georgia moved in the direction of liberality rather than in the opposite direction.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. I believe that it had been previous to the 1930s and the 1940s before this came in. I believe that it was you had to be a party candidate. In other words, you couldn't get on the general election ballot. But I'm not sure about that, and I apologize.
Mr. Castellani, in your recital of possible interests of the state, you did not mention that one sometimes included the possible fraud on the voters. I'm thinking of a case in the state of Nebraska some years ago when Senator George Norris was up for re-election and there was a great effort to defeat him, which I think, as I recall the history, succeeded. And one of the mechanisms was to find a man by the name of George Norris and put him on the ballot to divide the vote. Is that, whether we call it compelling or not, is that a legitimate state interest to have some limitation, whether it's 5% or 10 or 15 or 3?
Yes, sir, I would agree that it would. As I preface my remarks, I don't pretend to be an expert in the area of election laws, and I think that this court, in its experience, has certainly come across more cases and is more aware of the interest that a state has than I could. I think of the ones that I think are the most obvious to most people who are in this area. But of course, this court surely that is a legitimate consideration.
Mr. Castellani, is it true that the primary case, the white primary case in Georgia came around 44? And prior to that time, there wasn't but one party in Georgia?
Which white primary case, Mr.
King
Castellani? I'm not familiar with that case, sir.
It was a case that opened up the white primary to let Negro Republicans vote in the white primary. There wasn't but two parties there then, right?
Again, I say I'm not familiar with the history of Georgia around 1944. So I'm
Could this have been to keep out third party? Could that have been the reason?
Could it have been to keep out third party?
Yeah.
I can't say. I can't say what the motives were. I can't say that there was one overriding motive over all these other motives. I just, I wasn't there, and I haven't been able to talk with anybody who's been able to give me one good reason why. They all have their own versions of what they recall, but that's it. And I doubt that would be evidence before this court anyway.
Well, for a while, it not only kept out third parties, it kept out second parties.
Yes, sir, but I'm not so sure that the law is the instrument in which kept out even any other second party. I think that
the fact was
the historical background.
There was just a single party.
Yes, sir. Because the second ground on which these nominating petition laws are challenged are that they violate this freedom of association right that's been recognized by the court in Williams versus Road. Of course, Williams' case is the touchstone case in this field. We hope that this court can see the differences between Georgia's laws and Ohio's laws. This court, several times in its opinion in Williams, stressed this entangling web, the totality of the Ohio structure that made it impossible for third parties to get on the general election ballot. We believe that we have shown that Georgia has only the actual vehicle itself. That's the only difference that there is. Now, we would like also to stress to the court that this law is not an absolute bar to appearing on the ballot. It may be treated by some as a bar, but it is not. We have indicated before, numerous candidates, both statewide candidates and local candidates, have gained access to the general election ballot through the petition method. Now, this is the method under consideration, the 5%. That's what we call it, the petition method, as opposed to the primary method. Yes, sir. The two most noteworthy examples statewide are, of course, George Wallace, and before him, Howard Bull Calloway, candidate for governor who received the plurality but did not receive the majority, and this court decided Fortson versus Morris that the legislature could go ahead and elected his opponent. Now, Mrs. Janess has argued that it is an absolute bar to her because she simply can't meet it. Well, we would first say to this court that there's nothing in this record to show that she or anyone in her class has ever tried to meet it. We don't know what kind of effort would be required because they've never tried, or at least the record doesn't show that they've ever tried to go out and gather signatures. Now, we will admit that some expenditure of effort is needed. However, as we have indicated before, expenditure of effort is also needed to win a primary. We believe that before you can gain access to the general election ballot, the state does have a right to require this showing. We also would point out to the court that the court decision below had removed the qualifying fee from paupers. As this court has also indicated previously, the nominating petition law does not impinge in any way on the right of Mrs. Janess to meet with others of her choice, to hold public meetings, to advocate any idea, to solicit members to her group, or in short, to do anything else to gain access to the minds of her fellow citizens and to seek to persuade them to her political point of view. Now, as I had indicated, 49 states have nominating petition laws. Again, some are higher, most are lower, some the same as Georgia's. However, as we've indicated, these other restrictions, we think, can at least point out to this court why, although Georgia on its face may be higher than some of the states, perhaps a majority of the states, that you can't just judge nominating petition laws on the number of signatures required. You need to go deeper into the election code, into the election scheme, if you're going to make a comparison of Georgia with the other states in the nation. We would stress to this court that election codes are not static instruments. They are continuously being revised. They are under study by the legislature, by private citizens groups, by interested people. We would ask this court to authorize the use of nominating petitions by the 49 states who depend on them to help their election laws. The national movement in election law today is to make it easier to vote, get people to the polls. We believe that the petition law has a valid requirement and has the state has an interest in upholding it. We would ask this court to affirm the judgment of the three-judge court below and authorize its use. Thank you.
I think we'll suspend now and let you begin right after lunch. Mr. Hanscock, you have 3 minutes left.
I just have the briefest of points, Your Honors. First, when my opponent says that the 1943 laws were less restrictive than the 1922 laws, he is just plain incorrect. In 1922, in the election code found in the 1922 session laws at page 100, it states very clearly that the names of candidates of each political party and also the names of any other candidates for the offices to be filled are to be placed on the ballot. And it further provides that all candidates for national and state offices or the proper authorities of the political party nominating them shall file notice of their candidacy, giving their names in the offices for which they are candidates with the Secretary of State. So the 1943 move from no petition requirements to 5% was in fact more restrictive. Up until that time, anyone could get on the ballot simply by filing a notice of candidacy with the Secretary of State. The second point I would like to make
You're
is
speaking
in
now the general election. It could be on the general election ballot.
That is correct. The law says in all elections other than primaries conducted by a political party, it shall be the duty to place on the ballot the names of party nominees and all others who have indicated they wish to be candidates.
Do you care to comment on the state's interest in terms of preventing fraud on the voters by use of the same or similar names?
Yes, I do. I think the state is adequately protected here in at least two ways. First, the closing date for petition requirements is the same date as the closing date for nominees who wish to enter into a party primary, so that you cannot come along after the party primary and file a notice of independent candidacy. Unless it's a foregone conclusion who's going to win the primary, the
sometimes that is in Georgia,
sometimes.
Isn't it?
Well, I think the election spirit in Georgia is a little more rough and tumble than that. It's probably safe to say it's a foregone conclusion that the party nominee is going to win. But
the party nominee was what?
The Democratic Party nominee usually wins the election. But there is a second restriction which the state has, and legitimately, and that is that party nominees appear on the ballot along with a party designation, such as Lester Maddox, Democrat. An independent nominee wishing to put a fraud upon the voters by appearing under the same name would not have that party designation. It seems to me that's a clear way of preventing what happened to Mr. Norris in Iowa. Those would be our points, and we would have nothing further.
Thank you, Mr. Ranscoff. Thank you, Mr. Castellani. The case is submitted.